First of all, I'd like to say thank you for inviting me from such a long way away, and I understand the price to pay is that I have to follow Sherry with a speech, which is always rather difficult. Also, I did want to bring greetings from our little group in France, Socialisme International, and just to say that the struggle in Australia does matter to us, and when we heard about the anti-war demos and about the S11 demos, it really does matter to us in Europe, and it is part of the same struggle. Okay, so what am I going to talk about? The biggest youth movement since 1968. And 68 has always been the symbol of people who thought something might be able to change about capitalism. And this was something which was really extremely impressive, and I was very lucky to be in the middle. So what was happening? Well, just like the US ruling class wants to, and the other ruling classes want to get hold of the mineral resources and control the world like that, of course the French ruling class, in exactly the same way, has the same sort of aims, that is to say, to make sure there's more profit and less for ordinary people. So for the last 10 years, the same old ritual as in other countries: privatizations, development of a two-tier education system to make sure that there's good universities for the rich and then shit universities for the poor, reorganizing education so that it's directly linked to the short-term priorities of business, introducing apprenticeships at 14 again, trying to take away the school leaving age of 16, trying to get the working class kids out of school quicker, cutting unemployment benefit, cutting pensions, I'll come back to that, the normal thing. They would like us to work harder, have less of a life, so that their profits can be 11% rather than 7%, because it's a bit harder to get the 11% than it used to be. So there has been in France regular resistance. First of all, the big struggles in 1995, for a month, Paris didn't move. The metro was on strike for a month. The buses were on strike for a month. Amazingly, people still used their cars. It took 7 hours to cross Paris, but people did it anyway. Yeah. And my friends used to say, "Why don't we hitchhike?" Which was actually quicker to walk. But there you go. And that was a first huge wage of resistance, relatively successful. It stopped the pension reforms, which came back 10 years later, but that's 10 years, you know. One of the results was obliging a left-wing government in 97 to introduce some reforms. The 35-hour week, France is the country in Europe where the 35-hour week has come in. And now it was with all sorts of conditions and so on attacked, but it was a major victory, an indirect victory of the 1995 movement. And the ruling class, what do they want? They wanted to organise themselves a Thatcher. They wanted to find a conservative leader who could unite an electoral base and really go to town, and they wanted an issue to do it on it. Well, their first idea was pensions. 2003, huge reform in pensions. Basically, you have to now work 2.5 years longer to get less money. And that was, the response was huge. You had 2 million people on strike, 9 or 10 days of action, millions of people on the streets, and we lost. We were lost because the union leaderships were not determined enough. At one point you have the union leaders talking to a mass crowd, and the crowd of workers are chanting, "General strike, general strike," and we didn't get the general strike because the union leaders were not having it. That implanted certain sort of atmosphere of defeat in the union movement, but things began to move up again 2 years later. 2 years later, victory at the polls, a referendum which destroyed the neoliberal treaty of Europe. That was a wonderful victory. All of the great parties, even the Greens, the Socialists, the right-wing parties, all said, "You've got to vote yes or you're racists. Yeah? If you're against Europe, you're a racist. So you've got to vote yes," and people said, "Fuck you, we're voting no." Because we want to, and the slogan was, "For a social Europe." So, electoral victory, but that's not the same as a victory where you actually transform people's everyday living conditions. And so we moved on to the next battle, which is the main one I want to talk about, 2006. They were saying, what is the issue? And they found their issue, and their issue was the contrat première embauche, the first employment contract, which means if you're under 26, even if it's your 26th job, if you're under 26, when you're employed, you have a 2-year trial period. For the first 2 years, the boss can sack you without giving a reason. No reason required, 1 week's notice, no reason required. Whereas protection has been relatively well maintained in France. And we looked at this and we thought, this is disgusting. What young woman would dare to get pregnant? What gay worker would dare to let people know he was gay? Who would dare to join a trade union? When you're in this thing, you're sacked. Why? I'm not telling you. You know, absolutely disgusting thing. And, however, the union leaders say, "Well, you know, we lost on pensions 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Sorry, but people are too demoralised. We can't organise a fight back." And so nothing was, it looked pretty bad, nothing was going to happen. And there was a demo of 10,000 students in the south, and another demo of 5,000 students in the north. And we went along to them and thought, we really didn't believe that it was going anywhere. We thought, you know, here's another one we've lost. And then suddenly it exploded. You've got an explosion of revolt. And very, very impressive, because the first thing is it's really started after the law had been voted. Now, normally if you're protesting against a law, you do everything you can to get the protest organised before the law's voted, because afterwards people think, oh, well, you know, I better go home and paint my bathroom, we've lost, you know. So it did explode later, and it looked pretty bad. It's not the case that French young people walk around being in revolt all the time. In the university I work in, which is a working class university in the southwest of Paris, Crete, it's called 20,000 students. I've been working there for 5 years. I have never seen one, before this movement, never seen one political meeting of any description. This is because at a working class university, half the students have to work at the same time as the studies. Three quarters of the students live at home with their parents, keeps them down a bit. They have endless numbers of exams that they've got to prove, they've got to be present at every class, and it's ticked off. It's like, a bit like the army, right? Nothing had happened. There'd been no strike in this university since 1968. And even at the beginning of the movement, when you have 10 universities occupied across the country, in Crete, nothing. When you had 20, in Crete, nothing. It had to go through 6 weeks before the people in Crete would stop saying, it can't happen here. And then in this university, which I always held the correct position, of course it could happen here. Didn't believe it. And then suddenly, there's a mass meeting of 200. And the next day, a mass meeting of 1,000. And the next day, it was the dream of a socialist teacher. I said to my students, let's not go to class, let's go to the mass meeting. And there were 2,000 people there, and they voted. And they voted to blockade the campus. We blockaded the campus as absolutely incredible atmosphere. And we, by this time, well, the number of just to go back to the situation in the whole country, you've got the 7th of March, 1 million demonstrators. The 18th of March, 1.5 million. 28th of March, 3 million demonstrators across the country. And on the 4th of April, again, 3 million across the country. But it's not just the explosion of revolts. Also, the number of universities blockaded. It was 30, then 37. At the end, we were about 75 universities blockaded. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. But it's not just a revolt. It's also a huge explosion of creativity. They had so many ways of really making things happen. Blocking motorways, letting the cars through free on the motorways, and shaking a bucket to help the struggle. We organised football matches on blockaded motorways. That's great fun. The students went round town throwing eggs at the temping agencies. You know, the agencies which give temporary work and give you 2 weeks' work and then you wait 6 months to get another 2 weeks. Went and sorted them out. Blocking the trains. Lots of spontaneity. Blocking the trains. Occupying trains. When there was a demonstration in Paris, in Marseille, they just occupied a train which was coming north. And that's how they got there. Really, a tremendous amount of creativity. Also blockading police stations with rubbish bins. And occupying employers' organisations' headquarters. A huge amount of activity. You couldn't even count them, what was going on. Within the occupied universities, more and more educational programmes, films about women's liberation, about gay liberation, about the peasants in the Chiapas, debates about different political things. There was really a whole education going on for a generation which everybody had said they're apolitical. And sometimes the students thought they were apolitical. I remember one of the movements 10 years ago, which was against higher student fees. I was selling a socialist newspaper on a demo. I got surrounded by 20 students chanting, "No politics, no politics." Yeah, it was not at all automatic that it should politicise like that. And it did politicise, and it went much further. In some of the meetings in the universities which I visited in Paris, they had a mass meeting with the students and said, now we're going to listen to a representative of the cleaning staff of the university to talk about their working conditions. And that's, of course, their working conditions are shit, and normally students don't really care that their working conditions are shit. But because they'd seen that they could change the world, then they were interested in what was the position of other people. In every university mass meetings, every day, 1,000 here, 2,000 there. In Poitiers and Toulouse, they had over 4,000, so they had to go over to the local rugby stadium and use it instead for their mass meetings. also a huge amount. The other thing they learned was a tremendous amount of how to organize a struggle democratically from below. That meant blockading the universities. You've got to blockade the universities because otherwise the students who are not in class get penalized. Those who get money from the government for studying, they don't get it if they're not on the attendance list. So you can't just say, if you want to strike, strike. If you don't want to strike, don't. You've got to blockade the universities, but you've got to decide it democratically. Every 2 or 3 days, mass meeting, we vote, do we blockade or not? And many universities said, oh, we're not blockaded on Monday because there's exams for so-and-so, and we're blockaded on Tuesday. And it was, but it was all democratically argued in each case. And they also set up a national student coordinating committee, met every weekend, 7 delegates for an occupied university, 3 delegates for the other, and they discussed what should the next step be. And this national student coordinating committee called, after the third meeting, for a general strike, called on students to go to workplaces to talk to workers about the situation, and also called on workers to add their own demands. And the other thing which I really noticed is different from 10 years before is I went to 5 or 6 universities during the meeting. The majority of the leadership of the young people were women. And that is something I've never seen before in France. I've been to 5 or 6 movements over the last 20 years. The majority vote for women, and they were far from all whites. That was really, you could really see how, first of all, the student population has changed, but also the attitude to who has the right to speak in movements has really moved forward. I think another thing which was inspiring was really the unity between students and workers. The unions were obliged to all come out behind the students. They hadn't wanted to do anything. But the movement was so big, all the unions, which is the first time for 45 years, all the unions signed to say they agreed. And so by the days of action, so we're calling these days of actions I just mentioned, you had civil servants, airlines on strike, teachers on strike. Wonderful one at the end of March. I was walking down on the way to the demo, I put the radio on, the news radio, and they were playing opera music because the news radio was on strike. So I thought, okay, and in fact the demonstration was the place I had to meet people was in the Place de l'Opéra where the opera is, and the opera had a big banner, Opera on Strike. Yeah. you couldn't really, an incredible atmosphere of people really doing things. The students in Cannes, they all went down to the docks, and the following day there were 300 dockers on the demonstration who'd gone on strike to support them. It was really a huge outrage that you could possibly treat our children like that, because that's how the workers saw it. And we really saw that there was something new happening. It wasn't students in solidarity with workers or workers in solidarity with students. What was happening is that more and more was really an idea that it's the same class. And looking afterwards at the statistics, we find that 5% of wage workers in France are students. 5% of wage workers are students. 30% of students have to work. And so really, it's not like 68, because in 1968 there were 200,000 students in France, and now there are over 2 million. And that actually changes the situation. So what you have is a class France, not solidarity between distinct groups. And I think that's extremely important. I had one more thing to say about that, but I forgot it. These smaller towns moved faster. And the reason the smaller towns move faster, one of the reasons, is the more working class in composition in the universities, because the people who have money send their children to Paris. The government tried every tactic they could imagine. Of course, the first one is, oh, well, they don't understand the law. So the students published huge numbers of copies of the law with comments next to them. The law students became very wonderful. You know that law students are like lawyers. They're all bourgeois until you need one. I'm stealing other people's jokes, but I'm sure they won't mind. Then they said only the privileged students are against the law. Of course, we're most worried about jobs for the poor black people in the suburbs. It's well known how our right-wing government really care about the poor black people in the suburbs. Until then, the high school students joined the fight. You had hundreds of high schools blockaded, including a very large number of lycée technical high schools, which are 3/4 black. And so you got wonderful interviews in the press with one young Arab guy, 18-year-old, saying, oh, I'm already fed up of my mother living in a block of flats which stinks of urine. If on top of that I get a shitty job, I just wouldn't be able to stand it. And I'm supporting this struggle against this dreadful law of theirs. So why was the government so determined? Well, the government wanted this to be the miners' strike of Thatcher. the old people in the room will remember that in 1984, Margaret, that the miners went on strike in Britain. It lasted a year, and Margaret Thatcher wanted to beat them because she wanted to demoralise the unions for 10, 15, 20 years. It cost her a fortune to win the strike. It was a complete disaster from an economic point of view, but it was worth her while because it did demoralise for a very long time. And this was supposed to be that. And so they went right up to the wire. The government went right up to the wire. The Prime Minister, de Villepin, put his career on the line. He doesn't have a career anymore. Every week, President Chirac was on television. He only appears on television in the crisis. It's amazing. Sort of, it's a bit like a sort of regal situation. It's like all the channels at 8 o'clock, you get the president. And finally, after the first three huge days of action, Chirac announced on television that what he was going to do is he was going to sign the law. That was the last stage of the process. But he was going to instruct the government not to apply it, that no contract of this type should be signed. And everybody really thought, well, that will be enough to stop the movement. Well, the following day we had 3 million people again, and suddenly they discovered that it was possible just to tear up the law. And he couldn't even save face. Normally, if they liked to save face, he couldn't even save face. It went extremely far. And, of course, they also used the third tactic, which they always use, repression. Hundreds of arrests. 3 months in prison for blocking a train. That's sort of really heavy sentences. You know, young kids are being behind bars for three months for sitting in front of trains to protest. So, tremendously vicious repression there. Nevertheless, there are weaknesses. There are weaknesses. The weaknesses of the movement, I just want to do that briefly, is that the atmosphere was there to go further. The atmosphere was there for workers to take advantage of this and move forward to take back some of the other attacks that had begun. And this did not happen, first of all, because the union leaders were determined it shouldn't go any further. They were prepared for the movement to fail. They were prepared for the movement to fail. That's why, I don't know if you followed the dates there, but there was a day of action, and then the union leaders said, we better have another one in 3 or 4 weeks. You know, I mean, the whole dynamic of the movement was in real danger, but they were always ready to sort of spill it out a bit and say, you know, well, we'll see when the next election comes along what we'll do about the right wing. They didn't really want it to happen. It was the young people who were determined to make it happen. It was very, very stressful for us old militants because the young people for whom it was their first movement, they knew they were going to win from the beginning. They were positive and certain. Now, we have seen a lot of movements, and sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. We didn't sleep very much. We were worried. The young people were worried. Said, "Ah, we'll win. Cheer up." They knew they'd win. And they were right. This time was great. And so, what does that mean? Well, that means that, you know, what was missing was there wasn't an alternative leadership. There wasn't a big enough far left to say, well, the union leaders say slow down, but, you know, we can give other ideas and really inspire people because we're sufficiently numerous to do so. So, in fact, the revolutionary left was, first of all, not big enough, but also didn't have the right ideas. You had one section of the revolutionary left say, well, students aren't workers, it's not really very important. And the other section, very, very good in the movement, serving the movement, building the movement, but not bringing out the politics. No political meetings in the universities until the movement's over because we don't want to divide people. Yeah? And so, really very, 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 very weak politics from that point of view. And that was really the weakness that meant it could have gone much further. Now, there has been an aftermath, there have been results since, a whole series of, first of all, in my university, they have political meetings now, it's incredible. There's been a whole mass movement to defend illegal immigrants, which has been massively successful this year, and it's directly because of the atmosphere that was created by the movement. I moved into a little sleepy town in the south of France so I can get a bit more relaxation. And when I arrived, I found that the two high schools in town were both on strike, and they were on strike to defend one young African against being expelled from the country because he didn't have papers. Yeah? And that's the sort of atmosphere that's become quite common and quite successful. And now with the presidential elections, which I'm not going to talk about now, there is a massive audience for radical left ideas. Massive audience. The sad thing is there are several radical left candidates. The good thing is that they all have meetings of 1,000 or 2,000 every night. It's really incredible atmosphere. And so, It's really after the movement has given hope to people, and that allows us to move out into a lot of other things, but we're going to have to sort out this problem of having a coherent, sizable organisation with politics which say we've got to go all the way and really scare them and make them lose face, because we need more victories like that, much more victories like that.